Thank you, and good morning, everyone. Can you all hear me? So the topic for today, all things are mortal but the Jews. I don't know if anyone recognizes that quote, but we will discuss it at the end. It's actually a phrase from Mark Twain's famous quote when he analyzed the Jews. And when we talk about anti-Semitism, generally we look at it as a very scary, negative, all the time, all around, but I'm going to try to put a little bit of a positive spin to it, if that's even possible, to have anti-Semitism and anything positive at all, but we'll try to take a look and see what we can learn from the past as well as deal with currently what surrounds us today. So our first source is from the Haggadah, which as we stand between Purim and Pesach, we know we say this phrase year in, year out. V'hi she'amda la'avoseinu v'lanu shelo achar bilvad amal aleinu l'chaloseinu ela shebechol dor v'ador omdim aleinu l'chaloseinu v'hakadosh baruch hu matzileinu miyadam. We know that in every generation, one person or nation that has stood against us to destroy us. But rather, in each generation, they stand against us to destroy us. But the Holy One, blessed be He, rescues us from their hand. So we know it's kind of part of who we are as Jews, that in every single generation, there will be one person, two people, our neighbors, those in charge, politicians, as we will see. Everywhere we go, every place we've ever been in, there has always been someone who has stood against us. Someone, something, again, anything we have ever faced, however, what happens at the end? HaKadosh Baruch Hu has saved us from it. God has saved us. So we say every year as we're sitting down, we're eating our Seder meal, we think, we reflect. Yes, in every generation it happens. We know it's going to happen. But on the flip side of that, we also know that God's hand is somehow going to save us from whatever we face. So where does this all begin? So in the Haggadah there is a discussion of that as well, kind of from the beginning. And one of the most famous places that people look to as far as when did anti-Semitism emerge or when did it start being part and parcel with who the Jew is, people refer back to the story of Yaakov and Esau. And in this quote we have here in source number 2, it's from Rashi, from the pasuk in which Esau and Yaakov see each other after not having seen each other since the time that Yaakov had stolen the brachot from Esav, and we'll read the English translation of this Rashi. Vayashkehu has dots above it. In the Sifri, we find a dispute about how to interpret these dots. Some say that the dots mean that he did not kiss him wholeheartedly. However, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, it is a well-known halacha that Esav hates Yaakov. Nevertheless, at that moment, he became merciful and he kissed him wholeheartedly. Interestingly enough, the phrase halacha biyadur, it is a well-known halacha, is unusual. It appears nowhere else in classical rabbinic literature, and it is unclear what is halachic about it. Is it really something that Rav Shimon Bar Yochai referred to as a halacha, that Esav, it's a law, that Esav hates Yaakov? Or is it more of something that we've kind of learned throughout the generations, that unfortunately there is this inherent dislike of the Jew? When it comes to the story of Yaakov and Esav, obviously there was a context to it. And whether or not it's an actual halacha, a law, that Esav hates the Jew, obviously that's, you know, up for grabs. Not that Rav Shimon Bar Yochai meant, and there are a lot of explanations on this, that he meant that it's an actual law that Esav hates Yaakov, but that it is something that has become part of the Jewish nation. That unfortunately, wherever the Yaakov goes, wherever the Jew goes, the hatred follows. So let's go to the next time we kind of see this hatred. We have to look at the Pesach story, or the story of the Exodus, in which we have Paro looking at the Jewish people. And what does he say? Again, famously, as we read it year in, year out, he said to his people, look, the Israelite people are much too numerous for us. Let us deal shrewdly with them so that they may not increase. Otherwise, in the event of war, they may join our enemies in fighting against us and rise from the ground. Now, this quote that Paro says is used during the time when Paro asks everyone, not asks, actually tells everyone that they must take their newborn baby boys and throw them into the Nile. But this quote is going to be used against us not only in Egyptian times, but throughout history. And what is it that Paro sees? What's the threat of the Jew? What's the threat of the Jew that he sees in this time period? That if, what does he say clearly? In the event of war, they may join our enemies in fighting against us and rise from the ground. So what are the Jews? We're a threat. That if someone comes against Egypt, perhaps the Jews are going to join the enemy. So let us not allow them to continue. Let's take their newborn baby boys. Let's throw them into the Nile. And he further enslaves the Jew. Now we move further into history. Obviously the Jews leave Egypt. They go to the land of Israel. They thrive in the land of Israel. And then that comes to an end with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the first Beis HaMikdash, by the Babylonians. The Jews go into the Babylonian world. They do pretty well in the Babylonian world. By the time the Persians take over, as we know from the Purim story, the Jews are doing quite well. They're getting quite comfortable in Persian society. They're enjoying the wealth around them. And then what happens? What usually happens, and we're going to see throughout history what happens as the Jews become complacent. The Jews are enjoying the lap of luxury in Persian society. We have another enemy that arises, that he looks at the Jewish people and he says to Ahasuerus, what does Haman say to Ahasuerus? Haman then said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the other peoples in all the provinces of your realm, whose laws are different from those of any other people and who do not obey the king's laws, and it is not in your majesty's interest to tolerate them. If it please your majesty, let an edict be drawn for their destruction, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the stewards for deposit in the royal treasury. Once again, an enemy analyzes the situation of the Jews. What are these Jews? Who are they? They're scattered throughout your realm. They're different from us. And Ahasuerus, if we get rid of them, trust me, it'll be better. It'll be better in our society if we don't have these Jews who are here, there. They don't even actually get along with each other. So we get rid of them. They're not following our Persian lifestyle to the extent that we want them to. Let's get rid of them. Obviously, as we know, Ahasuerus agrees to that. But then with the Purim story, luckily, with the help of Esther and Mordechai, we're saved from that attempted annihilation. And that was the first attempted annihilation when it came to the entirety of the Jewish people. Where Haman looked at the Jewish people and said, doesn't matter what this one looks like, that one looks like, I want all of them gone. Ahasuerus signs the decree for the future of the Jews within the Persian Empire to be completely annihilated, obliterated from Persian society. After the story of Purim, many Jews return to the land of Israel, realizing, hey, you know what? Maybe we're not so safe living outside of the land of Israel. Many return. We have the situation with Ezra and Nehemiah fortifying the walls of Yerushalayim, Jews living in Israel once again. And then we have the flourishing of the second Beis HaMikdash. First, we have the Greek control over Israel, story of Hanukkah. After the Greek control of Israel and the Maccabean revolt, Jews once again maintain control over Israel, but that's short-lived. And the Romans come in, they waltz in, literally with the help of, unfortunately, the Jewish Civil War helped the Romans take over Israel, and we have the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash in 70 CE. And as you all know, after the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, Jews are dispersed once again throughout the world. Where do Jews go? They go into the Roman Empire. Some who had stayed within the Persian world are still living, and we have Jews in the yeshivot of Sura, Pumbedisa, and we have Jews living in Western Europe under Roman control. Now, what happens to the Jews under Roman control? Well, the Roman Empire becomes Christianized. And now Jews are not only under Roman control, but when we get to the 4th century CE, now they are under Christendom. They are under Christian control once we have the Christianization of the Roman Empire. So let's take a look at the way that early Christianity dealt with the Jew. So the Jew finds themselves in many different situations. And when we talk about anti-Semitism, we begin with Paro analyzing the Jew. We went to Haman analyzing the Jew. And now we see the vast majority of the Jewish population finding themselves within the Christian world. We have to take a look at the way that the Christian world was looking at the Jew as well, to understand the development of anti-Semitism and understand how it still is a part of society today. So early Christianity, this is one of the first laws of Constantine, approximately 315 CE. We wish to make it known to the Jews and their elders and their patriarchs that if after the enactment of this law, any one of them dares to attack with stones or some other manifestation of anger, another who has fled their dangerous sect and attached himself to the worship of God, he must speedily be given to flames and burnt together with his accomplices. Moreover, if any one of them of the population should join their abominable sect and attend their meetings, he will bear with them the deserved penalties. Okay, so we see here the Jew now is referred to as the abominable sect, the dangerous. Now we become dangerous as we had been before in Paro's day, where if the enemy of Paro invaded, we were a danger because we may march together with the enemy. In Haman's day, we were scattered. We should not be tolerated because we weren't acting in the ways of those around us within the Persian society. In early Christendom, right off the bat, Jews are referred to as dangerous, as something to be avoided. Now, Augustine, as many of you may know, one of the early thinkers of Christianity, "For the wickedness of my people, he was led to death." This was said about Jesus, whom you and your parents led to death. In addition to us being dangerous and abominable sect, what is one thing that will be throughout society, even till today? There have been many, many polls taken as to how many within the Christian world still view the Jews as the ones who crucified Jesus. So from the beginning, we were seen not only as dangerous, but the ones responsible for the killing of their God or Son of God, depending on who you're referring to. So in terms of, again, early Christian thought, it's not only the dangerous aspect of the Jew, but here we are, and we were responsible. We led Jesus to his death, and therefore there will always be a stain on the Jew from the Christian perspective. Going further on to another source, again, an early church father, early Christian thought, and I'll read the bolded statement. "Are you not afraid that your wife will come away from that place possessed with a demon? Didn't you hear the argument in my earlier sermon, which proved clearly that the demons inhabit the very souls of the Jews, as well as the places where they gather? Tell me, how do you dare to return to the congregation of the apostles after you have cavorted with demons? After you have gone off and joined those who shed Jesus' blood, how can you keep from trembling when you return and eat from this holy table and drink this precious blood?" So again, another dark point of the Jew, especially within the medieval world. We're talking about, this is actually before the medieval world, but this becomes part and parcel with the way that people viewed us in medieval times. Not only did the Jews crucify him, not only are the Jews dangerous in that sense, but what else is inherently a part of the Jew? That we cavort with the devil, okay? That we have demons living among us. Now, if you talk to those who are illiterate and very fearful of demons and devils, and you spread rumors such that the Jews really have demons living within their homes, within themselves, that's a very scary thought. And that's why it was very easy to spread anti-Semitism throughout the Dark Ages into the medieval world within the Christian world. Go on to the next few sources, and these are all legal sources, one from Theodosius, one from Justinian, two from Pope Innocent. We can go on and on and on throughout the Christian world. We're just going up a little bit further in history. So we have 439 CE, 531 CE, and then into 1215, which will be the Lateran Council, the Fourth Lateran Council. So the Code of Theodosius, or the Laws of Theodosius in the early Roman world: "We believe it sinful that the enemies of the heavenly majesty and of the Roman laws should become the executors of our laws, the administration of which they have slyly obtained." This removes the ability of Jews to, again, work within the Roman society. They can't become any form of governmental official. They can never be over any fellow Christian, or not fellow Christian, but over any Christians. Why? Because the Jew doesn't have the same religion as us. And there's always the fear that you have the sly Jew. The sly Jew. Next is the laws of Justinian. We therefore ordain that no heretic, nor even they who cherish the Jewish superstition, may offer testimony against Orthodox Christians who are engaged in litigation, whether one or the other of the parties is an Orthodox Christian. Okay, so here where Jews lose their ability to offer testimony in court. So not only can we not have any positions of power, but even when there is litigation, if a Jew's word is brought in, it's not going to hold any power whatsoever. So the power of Jewish testimony is also taken away. Furthermore, when we go into the later world, into when we start seeing the crusading period, when we see Jews living side by side their Christian neighbors, things become even more complicated for the Jew. Pope Innocent, in the Fourth Lateran Council, states, "The more the Christian religion is restrained in the exaction of interest, so much more does the knavery of the Jews in this matter increase, so that in a short time they exhaust the wealth of Christians. Wishing therefore to provide for Christians in this matter, lest they be burdened excessively by the Jews, we ordain through synodal decree that if they hereafter exert heavy and unrestrained interest, no matter what the pretext be, Christians shall be withdrawn from association with them until the Jews give adequate satisfaction for their unmitigated oppression. Also, the Christians shall be compelled, if necessary, through church punishment, from which an appeal will be disregarded, to abstain from business relations with the Jews." Now, this is in 1215. What happens in between 531 and 1215? So, the Roman Empire, the Western Roman Empire, is dissolved. The Eastern Roman Empire, in the form of the Byzantine Empire, still continues. But when we refer to the Western Roman Empire, we're talking about the areas which are currently France, and Germany, and England, and Belgium, and, of course, on the Iberian Peninsula, Spain, Portugal. Jews living in those areas throughout what will be the early medieval world. Pope Innocent, sitting in Western Europe, looks at the situation of the Jew and says he has to do something. We take a look really quickly at just the chronology that I have listed here. It's actually in source 11, the timeline, real quickly, so you can kind of get your bearings as to what time period we're referring to here. So Rabbeinu Gershom lived the end of the 900s. Then there's Rashi living through the First Crusade, 1096, Second Crusade, 1145. Blood libels began in England, the first one, 1144. 1171, the first blood libel in continental Europe. And then the burning of the Talmud in 1242. Going on, Jews expelled from England in 1290, Jews expelled from France and Germany starting in 1306 and then throughout the 14th and 15th centuries, then ultimately the Jews expelled from Spain in 1492. So back to our source of Pope Innocent. Pope Innocent looked at the situation of the Jew, and Jews were forbidden from entering many professions. So what did many of them go into? Moneylending, okay? It was an open profession to the Jew because Christians could not take interest from other Christians. Jews were not permitted to engage in other forms of trades, so Jews went into moneylending. The problem became Jews many times, and as you can see here from Pope Innocent's words, many times charged really high interest rates, okay, exorbitant interest rates. Now, the Christian world looked at it and said, that Jew, okay, those Jews, they're stealing our money, they're charging us crazy high interest rates. But in essence, if you actually take a look at what happened, the reason why Jews had to charge those exorbitant interest rates, because many times what happened was, if the Jew was owed money, then sometimes they were paid back, but sometimes there would be conveniently, in the location in which the Jew was owed money, or Jews plural owed money, all of a sudden, a Christian child was found dead. And that Christian child was then found on the doorstep of a Jewish home, or in the shul, or hiding in the Aron Kodesh, okay? And whenever there was a blood libel, not only did the Jews of those towns get killed most of the time, but any debt owed to the Jews of that town and surrounding towns, to make sure, okay, the money that was owed to those Jews was not paid back either. So yes, in fact, Jews did start charging high interest rates, but it was due to the circumstances. given the fact that many, many times the money that they lent was not paid back, so they charged more interest for the sake of maybe covering the money that wasn't actually going to be paid back, probably half of the time. So Pope Innocent looks at the Jew and he says the situation is so horrible at this point, and he calls it the knavery of the Jews in this matter and how it has increased. And what does he do, of course? He's going to go one step further, and he's going to state, in some provinces, a difference in dress distinguishes the Jews of Saracens from the Christians, but in certain others, such a confusion has grown up that they cannot be distinguished by any differences. Thus, it happens at times that through error, Christians have relations with the women of Jews or Saracens, and Jews or Saracens with Christian women. Therefore, that may not, under pretext of error of this sort, excuse themselves in the future for the excesses of such prohibited intercourse, we decree that such Jews and Saracens of both sexes in every Christian province and at all times shall be marked off in the eyes of the public from other people through the character of their dress. Now, this is the decree in which Jews started to have to dress differently throughout medieval Europe. This was to protect, here Pope Innocent says, to protect the Christians from lest they end up mingling with the Jewish world, lest they have the unfortunate situation in which they cannot tell the Jew from the Christian. Moving on to essentially what happens throughout Jewish history. In addition to the mode of dress that starts to change, or Jews having to wear distinguishing dress to show that they're a Jew, was this actually only to prevent any relations between Jew and Christian? No, it went a lot further than that. If there was a Jew crossing a bridge in medieval Europe, and let's say to cross the bridge it costs, you know, we'll use an example of, let's say, today's equivalent, but it cost $1 to cross the bridge, or $1.50. I'll buy the GW bridge, it costs $1.50. But if it cost $1.50 to cross over the bridge, the Christian would be charged $1.50. The Jew would be charged at least $10.50, okay? So as the Jews are walking through or traveling through medieval Europe, and they're distinguished by their Jewish dress, you better believe they're paying the price, literally paying the price for traveling throughout medieval Europe. And in addition to Pope Innocent changing the way that Jews dressed, he's also very much responsible, as you see here, the burning of the Talmud. It wasn't only that Jews are charging interest and we have to protect those from the Jews who are charging these crazy interest rates. But in addition to that, we have to make sure that nobody is learning their blasphemous Talmud. And in 1242, the Talmud is burnt in France. Now, what changes in the world in general? So medieval society, we understand the way the medieval society worked, the feudal system. We know there was a high level of illiteracy. So if you're told that the Jew worships the devil, you believe the Jew worships the devil. If you're told that you need to stay far away from the demons of the Jew, you believe that. But then we get into the modern world. We have the scientific revolution. We have the industrial revolution. We have the period of the Enlightenment. People are thinking of rationalism, rational thought. They're thinking all men are created equal for the first time in society. No more serfdom. No more classes. So what happens to the Jew? We would think the same thing. The Jew who was downtrodden, not allowed in other professions. What happens to the Jew during this time? So let's take a look at our first source, Voltaire, in 1756. Voltaire, who many of you know, who've read Voltaire, has many enlightened thoughts. Really great ideas about the rational world, about how we understand society and mankind and science and philosophy in general. But when it comes to the Jew, Voltaire's not there. To say that the Egyptians, the Persians, and the Greeks were instructed by the Jews is as if one were to say that the Romans learned the crafts from the people of Brittany. The Jews never were natural philosophers, nor geometricians, nor astronomers. So far were they from having public schools for the instruction of youth that they had not even a term in their language to express such an institution. The people of Peru and Mexico measured their year much better than the Jews. Their stay in Babylonia and Alexandria, during which individuals might acquire wisdom and knowledge, trained the Jewish people as a whole in on art save that of usury. So Voltaire looks at the Jew and says, what are they worth? They were in every single society. They can't get their calendar down. They don't know anything about math. They don't know their philosophy. They didn't learn anything at all from every society that they were in, except for money lending. Okay? Now, obviously, we know that that's not true. Okay? If you look at the Jews in the Golden Age of Spain, for example, among the greatest philosophers and mathematicians and philosophers throughout history have been Jews. So we know that Voltaire was taking a look at society and looking at Jewish history and not necessarily looking at it in a very nice frame of mind. But what's interesting about this source is that Voltaire is a modern thinker, okay? He's an enlightened thinker, and yet that enlightenment can't apply to the Jews. It just can't. It just can't. We go further into what's happening throughout society now into the modern world. We have Voltaire and others within the enlightened thinking zone, okay? And we have those who start discussing citizenship. Citizenship for all. Can the Jew, however, be included in citizenship? Now, we know people start getting citizenship throughout Western Europe. Those who had been illiterate serfs tied to the land now are among the citizens of society. Can that actually happen to the Jew? The truth is that, yes, it starts happening to the Jew throughout the 1800s. By the time we reach the late 1800s, the last place to give Jews citizenship within Western Europe, being certain areas within Germany, that the Jews do achieve full citizenship in Germany and throughout Western Europe by the end of the 1800s. But throughout the 1800s, there was a back and forth whether or not Jews should be granted citizenship. Now we'll take a look at some of the arguments in which they should not be granted citizenship, upon which, yes, other people that look like them and act like them, but the Jew is a different story. One of the back and forths is between an individual named Herr Dom, who was an advocate for Jewish citizenship, and another individual by the name of Johann David Michaelis, who has an argument against his colleague who says that Jews should get citizenship. This takes place in 1782. You can find it here, and anyone interested in furthering their study, The Jew in the Modern World is an excellent source book, and the vast majority of the sources I have here are coming out of this book, so I just wanted you to make note of that. Herr Dom admits candidly that the Jewish brain is far more harmful and more corrupted than that of other Europeans, an admission which several defenders of the Jews were hitherto unwilling to make. He seeks the reason for this, however, in the condition in which the Jew lives, reviled, oppressed, and forced to support himself almost exclusively from trade. Herr Dom has probably no idea to what extent I agree with him in this matter. I wrote exactly the same thing 30 years ago in a piece. I would like to express my opinion as it was then and as it is still today. Mine goes one step further, however, than does that of Herr Dom, in that it takes account of the deceitfulness of the Jews. So Herr Dom, who was a defender and actually a friend of Moses Mendelssohn, who was a defender of the Jews and argued for Jewish citizenship, nevertheless admitted that the Jewish brain is far more harmful and more corrupted than that of other Europeans. Okay? He blames that on the fact that we were placed in ghettos and that we were not permitted to enter into different types of occupations. But nevertheless, he says that inherently the Jewish brain acts in a way that's more harmful than anyone else. And he takes it a step further, arguments against them in his work, and says Jews should not be granted citizenship. Why? Because the inherent deceitfulness of the Jew. So even if they can perhaps get out of their ghettos and join our society, he makes the argument that the Jews are inherently deceitful and therefore should be denied citizenship as every other member of society. Now here we'll take a look at another statement coming out of an individual from Germany, Wilhelm Marr, who is thought of as one of the founders of modern anti-Semitism as a doctrine. What does he say? There is no stopping them. Are there clear signs that the twilight of the Jews is setting in? No. Jewry's control of society and politics, as well as its practical domination of religious and ecclesiastical thought, is still in the prime of its development, heading toward the realization of God's promise, "I will hand all peoples over to thee." By now, a sudden reversal of this process is fundamentally impossible, for if it were, the entire social structure, which has been so thoroughly Judaized, would collapse, and there is no viable alternative to this social structure which could take its place. Further, we cannot count on the help of the Christian state, the Jews are the best citizens of this modern Christian state, as it is in perfect harmony with their interests. We'll turn over to the next part. We have a lot of sources to get through, but I want to get to the folded part here. We should not reproach the Jewish nation. It fought against the Eastern world for 1,800 years and finally conquered and subjugated it. We were vanquished, and it is entirely proper that the victor shouts, "Woe to the vanquished." German culture has proved itself ineffective and powerless against this foreign power. And he ends with, "The Jews were late in their assault on Germany, but once they started, there was no stopping them." What is Wilhelm Marr saying? That the Jew has really taken over. All these modern states, which became states in the 1800s, nationalism emerged, and by the time we reach again to the late 1800s, when Jews are granted citizenship throughout the Western world, they're granted citizenship within states throughout the Western world, which were not really states yet. But as he refers to the Jew, the Jews were late on their assault, but now they have taken over. And this theme that is stated in the late 1800s will become a theme that we will see throughout Nazi Europe. We see it even before that in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which I'm sure many are familiar, that the idea that Jews sat down at a table and they plotted to take over the world, and it was published and it was reproduced in the United States of America, and it was sent throughout Europe, that the Jews literally were plotting to take over the world. Now, that made sense in some ways when you look at the development of modern anti-Semitism in the late 1800s into the early 1900s, and it made sense to us in Nazi Germany. But mind you, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion has now been reprinted in 2018, 2019, and is being read and distributed throughout the world today. The same idea that the Jews and their inherent deceitfulness are plotting to take over the world, something that was proved to be a completely fabricated document, is nevertheless being reprinted, reproduced, sent out, distributed, read as if it is fact today. Next, "The Question of the Jew is a Question of Race," written in 1881. Now, this is a significant date, 1881, for two reasons. Number one, 1881 in the Eastern European world was a time when Jews were subjected to massive amounts of pogroms with the assassination of Alexander II. And Jews who had thought that they would finally become a part of Eastern European society, of Russian society, were actually beaten, their money confiscated, they were spit out on the streets by people who they had started to attend university with, by those who they thought they were finally going to fit into society. 1881 was a turning point in Jewish history in the Eastern European world, where Jews of Eastern Europe realized it's just never going to happen. But also in 1881, this is post the time of citizenship in Germany for the Jew. A question would still exist even if every Jew were to turn his back on his religion and join one of our major churches. Yes, I maintain that in that case, the struggle between us and the Jews would make itself felt as ever more urgent, although the struggle certainly is felt now, even when the Jews have yet to convert in large numbers. It is precisely the baptized Jews who infiltrate furthest, unhindered in all sectors of society and political life. When we looked at medieval anti-Semitism, a lot of it had to do with religion. And as you know, as you see, throughout the crusading period, throughout medieval world, Jews were given options. They were told, convert or die. When we get to the modern world, as you see very clearly here, you can't convert out of your Judaism. It is inherent. It is part of your blood. So when we get to our next document, you'll see how when Hitler stands up and says that all Jews need to be obliterated, any ounce of Jewish blood, it doesn't matter if you'd married a Christian, if you've become Christian, if you're a second-generation Christian, it doesn't matter. Because modern anti-Semitism no longer looked at religion. It wasn't about the Jewish religion. It wasn't about killing Jesus anymore. It was about the inherent deceitfulness, the inherent Jewish blood that had to be eradicated. Now, I have a footnote here about Richard Wagner. I wanted to alert you to that idea that a lot of the anti-Semitism that was happening in the late 1800s into the early 1900s, people would look at it and say, well, you can't be anti-Semitic out in the open. Okay, it's not a good thing. Jews are now citizens. You can't be out in the open. But that changes, and Wagner changes that a lot. Because what we see with him is that, and I'll just read again the bolded part, his works made anti-Semitism culturally respectable and generally facilitated the diffusion of racist doctrines. His political essays were greatly admired by Adolf Hitler, and his operas were regularly performed in Bayreuth in connection with Nazi party conventions. What was before something that, hush, hush, don't be anti-Semitic out in the open, it's not nice anymore, we're in the modern world, became culturally accepted throughout Germany, throughout what we see all over Europe. And now we get to Hitler, 1919. First Jewry is clearly a racial and not a religious group. All that which is for men a source of higher life, be it religion, socialism, or democracy, is for the Jew merely a means to an end, namely the satisfactions of his lust for power and money. His actions will result in a racial tuberculosis of people. Okay, again, we know that's a famous line of Hitler, and that was used over and over again as propaganda to scare the Germans, to say that the Jews, not only were we eventually going to take over Germany, but we carried dangerous diseases. We were tuberculosis. We were like the rodents carrying the black plague on the ships from country to country. We move on again, 1923, in his writings in Mein Kampf. Today it is difficult, if not impossible, for me to say the word Jew. Sorry, when the word Jew first gave me ground for special thoughts. At home, I do not remember having heard the word during my father's lifetime. I believe that the old gentleman would have regarded any special emphasis on this term as cultural backwardness. Again, we see this idea that you couldn't really say it out in the open. A derogatory term to say to the Jew was seen, even within Germany, within other Western European countries, can't make fun of the Jew openly as much because they were, in fact, citizens. But by the time we get into the 1930s, all that has changed. We have the cultural acceptedness of anti-Semitism. And how does it manifest itself? First, in the Nuremberg Laws, where we have the definition of what it means to be a pure-bred German. And I'm not going to go through all of these articles, but do note that in these Nuremberg Laws, we have marriages between Jews and citizens of Germany forbidden. We have Jews who are forbidden to fly the Reich or national flag or display Reich colors. Again, the Nuremberg Laws, everything to do to place the Jew in a different world. They are not part of our society in the modern world. They are a different race altogether, and all Jewish blood needs to be eradicated. Now, the Jews survived the Holocaust. We lose 6 million people, but we survive. We have the State of Israel founded in 1948. Jews finally are thinking, here we are, you know, we can survive anything, and maybe, just maybe, anti-Semitism will die down for a little bit. Maybe we'll be free. But here we are, and unfortunately, we're dealing with anti-Semitism, contemporary anti-Semitism, that is not so far off from what we dealt with all the way back in history. You have here several definitions of anti-Semitism as they stand currently today. Anti-Semitism, and this is firstly from 2008, and I'll just note the reason why I included all of these is because if you see the dates, we have 2008 listed here, 2013, and the last source that I gave you is the one that the United States has now actually accepted, of 2016. Now you will note that each one of these sources gets larger and larger and larger. So by the definition of 2008, by the time we reach 2016, there are more categories that need to be added to the definition of anti-Semitism, because unfortunately, the amount of anti-Semitic acts and even the ideas and written anti-Semitism has grown exponentially from year to year. So we'll start with the first definition. Anti-Semitism is a certain perception of Jews which may be expressed as hatred towards Jews. Rhetorical and physical manifestations of anti-Semitism are directed toward Jewish and non-Jewish individuals and or their property, toward Jewish community institutions and religious facilities. Such manifestations could also target the State of Israel, conceived as a Jewish collectivity. Anti-Semitism frequently charges Jews with conspiring to harm humanity, and it is often used to blame Jews for why things go wrong. It is expressed in speech, writing, visual forms, and action, and employs sinister stereotypes and negative character traits. So once again, when we backtrack a little bit and look at everything that we discussed throughout history, these things are coming out once again. Things that were not allowed to be said in the United States of America, or if they were said, people would react vigorously against it. Now, unfortunately, that's not necessarily the case. Going to source 20, we have a repeat of that definition, but I wanted to add a little bit more when you look at the bold part. So the definition that we just read from the European Monitor Center on Racism, whose definition of anti-Semitism was cited earlier, offers examples of how anti-Zionist and anti-Israel criticism becomes anti-Semitic regardless of the motive, denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, applying double standards to Israel by requiring of it behavior not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation, using symbols and images associated with classical anti-Semitism to characterize Israel or Israelis, drawing comparisons of contemporary Israeli policy to that of the Nazis, holding Jews collectively responsible for the actions of the State of Israel. One feature of contemporary anti-Semitism that continues an old stereotype is the concept of Jewish power, or the idea that Jewish lobbies and shadowy groups control the levers of economies and governments. Okay? Again, this is quoted from 2013, and this is very real for us. And one of the additions to this, as you can very clearly see, is that anti-Israel has now become a new form of anti-Semitism. And not only a new form, but a very staunchly new form of anti-Semitism. And another aspect to this, holding Israel to a different standard than any other country in the world, which, as we know, makes no sense. It just makes no logical sense. Why it is that when you look at the Human Rights Commission, when you look at the Human Rights Council, when you look at the refugee situations coming out of the UN, there are no other refugee groups that are still treated as refugees generation and generation and generation later. In fact, all other refugees from Rwanda's genocide, from Sudan, from any other genocide or attempted genocide in the world, they're all treated under one refugee group within the United Nations. There is only one group that is still a refugee group and has their own, and that is the refugee UNRWA for Palestinian refugees. Makes no sense. No one in the United Nations can explain it, nor will explain it. But as Jews, we kind of understand it because that's what happens. And we go further into 2016, and as you see here, this was a declaration made and agreed upon by 31 member states of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. And it was accepted in 2016, and now we'll just read again certain aspects to it that, again, have been added here. Calling for, aiding, or justifying the killing or harming of Jews in the name of radical ideology or an extremist view of religion. Making mendacious, dehumanizing, demonizing, or stereotypical allegations about Jews as such of the power of Jews as collective, such as especially but not exclusively the myth about a world Jewish conspiracy, or of Jews controlling the media, economy, government, or other societal institutions. Now again, this is another added feature because as we're seeing more and more and more today in 2019, things are being added. The media is helping promote a lot of the anti-Semitic old stereotypes. Social media obviously has been something that has helped many anti-Semitic groups get out there. We talk about, you know, Rise Up group in Ocean County when referring to what's happening in Lakewood and Jews being constantly harassed within the streets of Crown Heights or other areas within Brooklyn. Social media helps to spread this, you know. Did you push the baby stroller while you're walking past, okay? Did you knock the beanie off the guy's head? Did you join our social media group, or did you join our group to stop the influx of Jews into our towns? Zoning laws today are being used to prevent Orthodox Jews from spreading out. And it talks about, when we discuss Arabs and building Arabs, as we know, unfortunately, there are some communities that are told they can't spread any further because they're not allowed to continue to build an Arab to allow other Orthodox families to move in. These things are all adding to the culture within the United States. Accusing Jews as a people being responsible for real or imagined wrongdoing committed by a single Jewish group, person or group, or even for acts committed by non-Jews. Denying the fact, scope, mechanisms, or intentionality of the genocide of the Jewish people at the hands of the Nazis. Accusing the Jews as a people or Israel as a state of inventing or exaggerating the Holocaust. Accusing Jewish citizens of being more loyal to Israel or to the alleged priority of Jews worldwide than to the interests of their own nations. And as we will see, that question of dual loyalty has now been raised by a congresswoman. Denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination by claiming that the existence of a state of Israel is a racist endeavor. Any other country, any other people that has their own country can proclaim, I'm an Irish American, I'm a Canadian American, whatever it may be, but can you do the same? Can you stand for the state of Israel and still be a proud American? That's the question that is now arising within our society. Applying double standards by requiring of it a behavior not expected or demanded of any other Democrat nation, which we saw back in 2013 as well. Using the symbols and images associated with classic anti-Semitism, claims of Jews killing Jesus or blood libel, as we saw recently in a European parade, where you have big Jewish noses sitting on top of money bags parading through the streets. Drawing comparisons of contemporary Israeli policy to that of the Nazis and holding Jews collectively responsible for the actions of the State of Israel. It's no longer the State of Israel and people kind of critiquing the State of Israel. It has now become synonymous, State of Israel, with Jew. So here we have U.S. Congress 2019. First, we'll go back a little bit for the same now. Wasn't a congresswoman then. But we are referring to Ilhan Omar, who has stated in 2012, Israel has hypnotized the world. May Allah awaken the people and help them see the evil doings of Israel. That was in 2012, before being elected. In February 2019, however, Omar created another stir when she tweeted that support of Israel in the U.S. Congress was all about the Benjamins, suggesting that the pro-Israel lobby AIPAC was buying off American politicians. And then in March 2019, obviously very recent, okay, and as she discusses the fact that it was okay to talk about all about the Benjamins and that Jews are paying off the politicians within American society. So for me, I want to talk about the political influence in this country that says it's okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country. And I want to ask, why is it okay for me to talk about the influence of the NRA, of fossil fuel industries, or big pharma, and not talk about a powerful lobby? Once again, what was referred to here? The idea of dual loyalty. The idea that the Jews are buying off the American world, and that is the reason why American politicians have supported Israel and continue to support Israel, because in her words, Israel is obviously a state that has hypnotized the world, and one must do something about it. So is there an answer to any of this? This is a lot of, you know, fear-mongering here, okay? Where are we going with this? Well, we started all the way back with Paro looking at the Jewish people and saying, look, they're just dangerous, and Haman asking for the full annihilation of the people in Persia throughout the medieval Europe, where we knew of pogroms, and we knew of crusaders who came to our door and gave us the option of converting or dying. We went through modern anti-Semitic times, and which culminated in the Holocaust, in which there was no way to escape. Jews were inherently deceitful. We were cunning. We're all about the money. We're all about the power. None of that has gone away. In fact, as we see, the definition of anti-Semitism just keeps getting bigger and bigger every day. Can we explain it? Absolutely not. The only thing we can do is kind of look and take a message from it. And one of the messages we can find is from the Megillah. And that's when Zeresh, when Haman comes home, and the conversation between Haman and Zeresh, and Haman says he's going to hang Mordechai. You know, he wants to get rid of him, and he's just getting really, really angry. This man doesn't bow to him. Not only am I going to get rid of Mordechai, I'm going to get rid of that whole Jewish people. And in the words of Zeresh, what does she say? There Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had befallen him. His advisors and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordechai before whom you have begun to fall is of Jewish stock, you will not overcome him. You will fall before him to your ruin. So we see all the way back then, okay, all the attempted annihilations. Nevertheless, v'hisha amda, the words that we started with, the idea that in every generation it's going to happen. And unfortunately, it just keeps happening, and it just keeps happening. But we have that promise, that guarantee, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that God saves us from everything. And on another positive note, what we started with, the quote from Mark Twain, I'm sure everyone has read this before, but it's always interesting to see, especially since Mark Twain, those who have read a lot about Mark Twain, many view him as possibly having had some anti-Semitic leanings as well. But whether he did, whether he didn't, he clearly took a step back of his writings and started analyzing the Jew. If the statistics are right, the Jews constitute but 1% of the human race. It suggests a nebulous dim puff of stardust lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. Properly, the Jew ought hardly to be heard of, but he is heard of, has always been heard of. He is as prominent on the planet as any other people, and his commercial importance is extravagantly out of proportion to the smallness of his bulk. His contributions to the world's list of great names in literature, science, art, music, finance, medicine, and obtrusive learning are also a way out of proportion to the weakness of his numbers. He has made a marvelous flight in the world in all the ages and has done it with his hands tied behind him. He could be vain of himself and be excused for it. The Egyptian, the Babylonian, and the Persian rose, filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed and made a vast noise, and they are gone. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but it burns out, and they sit in twilight now or have vanished. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? So for that, we conclude on that note that, yes, unfortunately, anti-Semitism is around us and is increasing around us. But God willing, we shall survive it and hopefully come out stronger, and hope everyone has a very enjoyable Pesach and the Shana Haba B'Yerushalayim.